Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The United States has by far the biggest prison population in the world. An even greater number, though, is the number of people who are on parole and probation. And if you combine everyone in the United States that's under criminal justice supervision, those in prison and jail, that comes to one in every 31 adults. All of this is very expensive for states. Corrections is their fastest-growing budget item. Most inmates, well, they're eventually released, but recidivism rates are high. Is there something that we could do to make it so that once someone had been sent to prison, had served their sentence, and been released, that they don't go back? This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about community corrections, things that might be done to strengthen this system and perhaps reduce that rate of recidivism. And our guest for the program is William Burrell. He is an independent corrections management consultant. Among other things, he specializes in community corrections. Between 2003 and 2007, he was a member of the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. And before joining the faculty there at Temple, he served for 19 years as chief of adult probation services for the New Jersey State Court System. He's chairman of the editorial committee for Perspectives. That's the Journal of the American Probation and Parole Association. He also serves as a member of the association's board of directors. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief. That way we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible, but certainly your participation in the program is welcomed. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's the number. We also have a toll-free line, and that one would be good for you if it would be a long-distance call, so if you're outside of the immediate Champaign-Urbana area. And that number is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Burrell, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Just to review the numbers a little bit here, how many people in the United States are in incarcerated?
Well, it's a little over 2 million are incarcerated in prisons and jails.
Mm-hmm. And then then the number, which is, I was kind of surprised, I think perhaps people would be surprised at this, then the number of people who are under some kind of criminal justice supervision, but they're out in the community, how many is that?
Well, there are more than 5 million adults that are on probation or parole in the community.
And then if you ask this further question, well, what's the percentage of people who have been in prison, have served some of their sentence, and then they are released, conditional on their good behavior?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we take that, just that piece first. How many people who are on probation actually successfully complete the terms of their release?
Well, let's break out probation and parole into
yeah.
two separate groups.
Okay.
And, probation, generally, people are sentenced to probation without any time in jail, although many jurisdictions have statutes that allow them to the judge to put some amount of time on the probation sentence behind bars. Parole, on the other hand, is always served after a period of incarceration. And as you might imagine, you get some different types of people on probation and parole. Since parole follows incarceration, you tend to get a more serious offender population, either have committed a more serious offense or have a more extensive prior record, and they would get prison time as a result of that. And the outcomes of parole supervision mirror that same set of facts, that we tend to have a group of people who have longer records, more serious offenses, and more serious problems in their lives. And the failure rates or the recidivism rates on parole are higher than they would be for the probation population.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, has done two large studies of post-prison outcomes. And in both instances, better than two-thirds of the people released from prison committed a new crime or arrested for a new crime within 3 years of being released from prison.
Hmm.
The probation numbers are a little bit better. The federal study by BJS, the recidivism rate, excuse me, was around 43% for probationers having 3 years after they were released from probation supervision.
Mm-hmm. So the point, we can go on and talk about this in detail, but I guess the bottom line here of the conversation, the point of having it, is the idea that if the systems that were in place in the community were stronger, then we could either reduce the number of people who are on probation who end up reoffending and going back, or by the same token, also the numbers of people who are on parole, I've got that
right. Yeah, you're right.
Essentially, the people who are on probation, we don't want them to reoffend and end up going to jail. People who are on parole, we don't want them to reoffend and end up going back to jail. So the idea is that if we could strengthen those systems, that once people were through the justice system one way or another one time, that we could see if we could reduce their chances of going through the system again, and then ending up either in jail for the first time or in jail for the second time.
Right, that's correct. Yeah, I think one of the hardest challenges we face is how to build within both probation and parole the capacity to provide good quality services to offenders to deal with the problems that got them into trouble in the first place. We are unfortunately still dealing with the legacy of the Get Tough on Crime movement that really began in the mid to late 1970s, where the response to crime was to lock people up, lock more people up, and lock them up for extended periods of time. And at the same time that happened, there was a movement, so to speak, that based on some research that suggested that rehabilitation and offender treatment was not effective and that it was not working to deal with the problems that offenders had. So as prison populations grew, the programs and services that used to be provided to help inmates incarcerated were eliminated. So we ended up with a situation where we were locking more and more people up for longer periods of time, and little, if any, was being done for them while they were incarcerated to deal with things like drug problems, lack of employment skills, lack of education, and so on. And we know from the research that these are things that contribute to people getting into trouble again. So the challenge is, how do we, in the community, on probation parole, provide services that have not been available to offenders before, so that we can mitigate the problems, these factors that continually drive them back to a life of crime.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, one of the ways that you can make the argument, if you just want to make it in a kind of a hard-nosed dollar and cents sort of way, if you can look at what it costs to keep someone in jail, and then the amount of money that we would be spending on these community services for somebody on parole or probation, and it's a lot more expensive to incarcerate someone. So if you even – you could make the argument that way, apart from, you know, any of the other benefits of trying to prevent somebody from reoffending, it's a whole lot cheaper if you invest in those community services than if you invest in building more prisons.
That's right. And that is, I think, the most interesting development over the last few years, is that even in places – in this country where you would expect a very hard-nosed, tough-on-crime attitude, places like Texas, for example, they have restructured their system. They've invested heavily in community supervision, drug and alcohol treatment, and they're doing it primarily because they recognize, from a fiscal point of view solely, the futility of continuing to do what we've been doing for the last 30 years. It's not producing the results that we want, and you mentioned the cost of incarcerating somebody, it averages about $30,000 a year to hold somebody in a state prison. Some states are higher, some are lower, but that's about the average. And even the most sophisticated, high-service probation or parole supervision is not even going to approach a tenth of that. So if we're even talking about the best we have to offer in the community, it's still a fraction of the cost. And we can also demonstrate, I think, that if we provide the right services, it will be more effective. effective at reducing failures in the long run.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I looked at to have some things to think about in preparation for this conversation was this recent report by the Pew Center on the States about community corrections. And one of the points that the report makes is that the number of people in the United States who are in prison, that issue has gotten quite a lot of attention. You know, it has a fairly high media profile, but that most people, and I guess I certainly would have counted myself among them, don't know that there are many more people who are somehow under court supervision in the community than there are in jail. And I wonder why it is you think that the level of awareness there is not, and maybe it is because it just doesn't get as much coverage.
Well, it doesn't get as much coverage, and it's also, there's some fundamental differences between a prison and probation, for example. You can actually go to a prison and you can look at the physical facility and you can take a tour and you can see all of the inmates that are locked up in that facility. So if it's a very crowded facility, let's say they have bunks in the dormitories and in the gymnasiums and they're triple celled in the actual cells themselves, you can see the prison crowding tangibly and feel it. Unfortunately, we never assemble all of the people who are on probation in one place at one time. They're spread out in the community, living in the neighborhoods and working and so on. So it's difficult to see the crowding that exists within the probation and parole systems because of that factor. The other problem is that probation and parole tend to have a very low profile in the community, whether it's from a media point of view, a political point of view, and so on. So there's just a very low level of knowledge about the work that we do and of the workload that the probation and parole officers around the country carry. So to hear you say that you were surprised about the number of people, the proportion of people that are on probation and parole, doesn't surprise me. And it's interesting to note that this ratio of incarcerated to non-incarcerated offenders has been around since the federal government started keeping these statistics back in the early 1980s. It's always been in the neighborhood of 70% of the adult offenders are in the community on probation and parole, and about 30% are either in state prisons or in local jails.
Mm.
So this is not a new phenomenon. This is something that's been around for quite some time, yet we haven't... until the Pew report, really haven't had a high-profile report that points this out and then also begins the dialogue about the sheer cost of that strategy.
Yeah. Just one other point, and I'm going to go to a caller here, just to pick up on something that you mentioned or have you talk a little bit further. There's been this significant increase in the numbers of people on parole and probation, and by the same token, the resources that go into trying to supervise those people have not. So can you say something about how for, parole officers or probation people who are in charge of monitoring these individuals, what's happened with their caseloads over the last couple of decades?
Well, it's not hard to figure out. Caseloads have gone up and significantly. In my own experience in New Jersey, for example, when the war on drugs hit our state, we went from an average adult caseload in 1981 of 110 per probation officer. By 1987, when the drug war had really hit full tilt, those caseloads were now an average of 189. So it doesn't take much to figure out that the impact of that type of increase in workload will really have a serious effect on the officer's ability to do their job. And, you know, even the 110 caseload, which is about what the average is around the country at this point in time, even that is a difficult number to manage. I suggest to people as a way to think about a probation or parole officer's caseload, to make a list of 100 people that they know, friends, neighbors, acquaintances, whatever, and then write down what they're doing right. Give me a short status report on what those people are doing right now. And people struggle with that because it's hard to keep track of 100 people, even ones that are your friends and neighbors and acquaintances and so on. So to think of the job of the probation parole officer to keep track of at least 100, sometimes even more, offenders, and it's not just to keep track of them, but to also hold them accountable for their behavior, compliance with the court or parole board orders, and so on. It's a massive job, and as those numbers go up, the level and quality of service goes down. Mm-hmm.
Just maybe one more thing. I'm looking at the report here, and it brings the point home very dramatically how under resourced these systems must be, and also and particularly when you think about the numbers that we gave before about how many people there are who are in prison, like something like 2.3 million people in jail in the United States, but on probation there are more than 5 million, or maybe that's probation and parole.
Probation and parole.
Together. If you take a look at, and there's a pie chart here that makes it very dramatic, at total corrections spending, this is across 34 states, nearly 9 out of every 10 correctional dollars went to prisons. So the amount of money they're spending on their prisons, that's 88%. The amount of money they're spending on probation and parole, that's 12%. And that's in spite of the fact that there are more than twice as many people on probation and parole as there are behind bars.
That's right. And that's some of the frustration that folks in community corrections feel. They're carrying the majority of the workload, but they're not getting a fair share. Now, certainly operating a prison, it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation. Typically have 3 shifts, and all the posts need to be covered, and people need to be fed, and health care needs to be provided, and so on. So there's a lot more that's involved with running a prison compared with a community corrections operation. But that being said, the allocation of funds is vastly disproportionate, and we know that if we had a greater share of the resources, caseloads could be driven down to a more manageable level. Services could be made available, treatment and educational and vocational services could be made available, and the problems that drive people to commit crimes could be addressed and mitigated, and overall the community would benefit. Because fewer people would fail, fewer people would go back to prison or jail. They would become productive, tax-paying members of society, supporting their families and dependents, and just generally being a productive member of the community.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Burrell. He now works as an independent corrections management consultant, specializing in a number of things, including community corrections. He was, for a number of years, a member of the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University. That's in Philadelphia. And before that, he served for 19 years as chief of adult probation services for the New Jersey State Court System. And we're talking about community corrections, that is, what we do for those individuals who are in the community under some kind of criminal justice supervision. And those could be people who are either on parole or probation. And the point, as we have made it, the important point is that there are many more of those kinds of people than there are people behind bars, and that if we're interested in trying to keep those people out of jail, then we ought to be paying attention to this kind of system that we have here in place in the community. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and we have several callers here lined up and ready to go. We'll start with Bloomington, Indiana, and our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hi. Have you heard of the organization called Prison Fellowship? Have you heard of that organization?
Yes, I have.
Well, that organization reforms inmates. It has reduced recidivism by producing a religious conversion in criminals. And about your mission of community corrections, some of the former inmates that had been through the Prison Fellowship Program will come back and participate in prison ministries. In other words, ministering to other inmates. I participate in a local jail ministry here, and we have several people in that ministry who were former inmates who have gotten their lives straightened around, and now they're helping other inmates. And I think it works very well. At least Prison Fellowship says that they have statistics that say that they can reduce recidivism considerably.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with the research that they've produced, but the idea of former inmates helping present inmates through a mentoring kind of process is very powerful. In fact, we had a program in New Jersey that intensive supervision program where we had former participants come back. We used to call them an alumni group, and they would talk with the current participants in the program. Basically, you know, to help them deal with it, whatever situation they might find themselves in. But it's they can talk. The former inmates can talk at a level that the most skilled professional can't, because those former inmates have been there where the current inmate or current offender is, and they've dealt with the same kinds of situations and challenges, and they've been successful. So it's an important point to show them that, hey, I did it, I struggled, I stumbled, but you know, you can do it too. So there's a certain power in that kind of person and what they say and what they do with the current offenders. And we also have found in the field in probation and parole that the faith communities have stepped up to the plate very powerfully and effectively to help offenders get resettled. These are churches, for example, that that are in the communities where the offenders live, and they so they have a vested interest in helping these released offenders get settled, reunite with their families, get jobs, deal with their drug and alcohol addiction, and make that successful adjustment to life back in the community. And they have been extraordinarily effective, again, because they're from the community. There's the grassroots, and they're committed to finding a way to help these released offenders adjust because they're living in that faith organization's community. So I think it's a valuable contribution that both former inmates can make with people while they're still incarcerated, as well as the faith community with offenders once they've been released back to our towns and cities.
Another great contribution that communities could make, and this would not be to deal with former inmates, but to prevent people from going into crime in the first place, would be to strengthen families. Our families have just become very much weakened.
Mm-hmm.
The divorce rate is high. There was a statistic just, I think, a week ago or so, 40% of our babies are now born out of wedlock. That means those babies don't have a father in the home. They don't have a decent male role model. Our inner cities are full of fatherless children who have no wholesome value formation. Well, those boys are going to grow up in that dysfunctional situation, and they're going to go to jail. We need community programs to strengthen families, reduce divorce, make certain that people are married before they have children, and our prison population will go down. I believe it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's some significant research to support your point. There's a group out at the University of Colorado that has developed a series of programs they call Blueprints for Violence Prevention, and they focus on youth, on children, on families, intervening early to deal with some of the challenges and problems that later on produce crime and delinquency. And in fact, one of the most interesting programs in that set of the Blueprints programs is a nurse-practitioner partnership, where nurses actually work with young women who are pregnant even before they give birth, to help deal with prenatal care and a variety of other issues. And they're finding that if particularly unwed mothers get involved with these nurse-family partnerships, down the road many years, there's reduced delinquency and reduced crime on the part of these family members. So we need to be thinking about our response to the problem of crime and delinquency, just not as one after the fact to identify and punish and incarcerate the offender, but also to be looking, as you have said, about families, looking at the situations that produce these offenders and finding ways to intervene and prevent problems from festering and becoming out of control. And it's an area where, unfortunately, for the last few decades, we've been focusing primarily on lock them up and punish the offender and not as much on prevention and intervention. And I think now we're beginning to see from the research that this is a much more effective way to do it. It's a much more cost-effective way to do it. And we're beginning to see, finally, as kind of mentioned before, the dollars and cents argument is beginning to take hold and beginning to overcome some of the ideology that for so many years was driving our decisions about crime and delinquency.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go on to somebody else. Next up is someone in the community of Belgium, not far away, in line number one. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. I would think we really need to start back at the beginning of the whole problem. And number one, we have lots more lawyers than any other country. We are a very litigious society that likes to put people in jail. And on top of that, we make laws. 50% of the people that are in jail are involved with one particular type of crime, and that's drug crimes. And the same laws that are causing problems in jail are also now causing problems on our border with Mexico. And that's going to be a very large problem. Maybe we ought to consider our laws and the way we institute them also in this situation, because a lot of these people who go to jail in these groups are not really violent offenders. They have a different type of problem that needs to be dealt with in a different way. This paradigm we have of find somebody with a bag of marijuana and throw them in jail for 10 years only adds to our problem.
Yes, I think you really hit the nail on the head with the drug problem. When you look at the statistics for the war on drugs in the 1980s and 1990s, lots of people got locked up in jail and prison for possession and sale, but a lot more people got placed on probation. Again, this is kind of one of the unknown factors that probation departments and parole agencies absorb the majority of the people that were caught up in this war on drugs. I think the challenge is to reorder our strategy, and it's going to be interesting to see now that we have a new drug czar who's been appointed by President Obama, to see how drug strategy changes. We've been focusing almost entirely on the supply side. Can we control, restrict, limit the volume of drugs coming into this country from the outside? And we've been spectacularly unsuccessful in doing that. I don't think anyone would argue that the money we've spent, the billions we've spent on that strategy has worked, and it has contributed to extraordinary amounts of violence, not only along the border with Mexico, but in our inner cities. It has contributed to the misuse of firearms. I think lots of the problem we have with guns these days is driven by the demand that the drug trade creates for weapons. So it's time to, at least in my judgment, to begin to step back and say, let's take a look at another part of that strategy, and that is the demand for illegal drugs. If we can help reduce that through treatment, prevention, intervention, stop people from using drugs, the market will dry up, and a lot of the problems that flow from the drug trade, which is violence and weapons in our communities, will recede.
Well, sir, I take exception with what you say there, in the fact that there's always going to be a percentage of our population, a percentage of people are going to be involved with compounds that are going to modify their behavior. It's just a fact of life. We use alcohol. We use all kinds of drugs for this. It's time we take a better look at how we want to deal with that problem and take the profitability out of it. Once you take the profitability out of it, you've taken the crime out of it. You've taken the murder out of it. You've taken a whole lot of things out of it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is William Burrell. He is an independent corrections management consultant. Before doing that, he spent several years as a member of the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. And before that, he served 19 years as chief of adult probation services for the New Jersey State Court System. He chairs the editorial committee for Perspectives. That's the Journal of the American Probation and Parole Association, and he also serves as a member of the board of directors of the APPA. And questions welcome. We're talking about community corrections and about programs in the community as an alternative to putting people or keeping people in jail. And again, really the question we're asking is that once someone has been caught and either sentenced to probation or has been caught and convicted of a crime and sent to prison, what do we do to try to prevent them from re-offending so they don't end up going to prison or maybe going back to prison? Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one of the report that I mentioned a couple times, and by the way, If people are interested in reading this and they have internet access, they can go to the website of the Pew Center on the States and read the report that we're talking about here. It makes a number of recommendations, and one is that that intervention programs should be based on good research, the research that tells us, well, what works and what doesn't, and which I guess raises in my mind the question, well, in the past, have we been doing things that actually didn't work? Or we didn't have good reason to think that they did. What does research tell us about what works?
Well, let me address that. What we've done in the past, and unfortunately, we have done a number of things that have been ineffective dealing with delinquents and criminals. Let me just give you two real quick examples. First one, back in the late 70s and early 80s. From my home state of New Jersey, we produced something called Scared Straight, which was a program where youthful, not even all offenders, sometimes they were referred from schools and other places, were sent to Rahway State Prison, where they spent a couple hours with a group of life-sentenced inmates who basically tried to scare them into not getting into trouble again. And this was, you have to give the inmates credit. They wanted to try to do something to help, you know, reduce juvenile crime, but fact is that that kind of approach, scaring an offender, a youth, is not going to work. And in fact, the research very clearly showed that not only did it not deter juveniles who were already in the juvenile justice system, it actually made some kids worse. So it was something wasn't grounded in any sort of theoretical research. It was a kind of a feel-good, almost intuitive type of a program that had a negative impact. The second example happened about a decade later when pretty much every state decided that the military boot camp model was a good way to deal, particularly with young drug offenders, to straighten them out and show them the error of their ways. The research is pretty clear. Almost all of those programs failed in terms of their two major missions, and the first was reduction of recidivism, and the second was reduction of prison crowding. And again, the idea, kind of intuitive thought that, well, it makes soldiers out of young men, for, you know, for the military. It would be a good idea to do with offenders. Again, with no empirical evidence to suggest that it would work. So we've done things like that over the years, made decisions and established programs that are based more on ideology or on intuition and gut feeling, and not on solid empirical research that would say that, you know, that's not really likely to work.
Mm. Well, let me turn that around and say, well, based on the research, what kind of things are likely to work?
Well, it's really clear that you want to begin to address something that we call in the field criminogenic factors. It's a big word, but it basically means the things that drive people to commit crimes. And if you can reduce or mitigate those factors, you can reduce crime. It's a very simple equation. So, for example, most powerful of the factors, when you look at the research, is a set of attitudes, values, and beliefs that offenders have that are pro-criminal. In other words, they believe that it's okay to commit crimes, it's okay to steal, it's okay to use illegal drugs, and so on. So what we have to begin to do is to work with those offenders to identify those factors, those pro-criminal attitudes, and begin to help them see how they hurt other individuals, they continue to drive that offender into the system, and begin to show them how they can live a successful life in the community without acting by those values. Mm. Other ones include hanging out with other people who have similar attitudes, values, and beliefs. It's rare to see, you know, offenders who commit crimes on their own. A lot of it tends to happen together, but they hang out with a group of people that have the same set of values and beliefs that they do. Substance abuse is a huge driver. Lack of education, lack of vocational skills and employment. So if we can begin to address these factors in individuals' lives with programs that give them the skills that they need, provide them with the education, help them reshape their values and attitudes, we're going to begin to see reductions in crime by offenders under supervision.
Yeah. There's something else that I think, and I don't know, perhaps people who have been involved in the criminal justice would say this was naive of me, I don't know. But it does, the report also suggests that it would be productive to think about providing incentives, actually, to people. So instead of, or perhaps alongside of saying to the person, if you reoffend, we're going to lock you up, and mm-hmm. you're not going to like that, to try to find some way to say, if you don't offend, that you're actually going to, and you know, if you get yourself together, if you get some education, we'll see if we can help you get a job. If you stay out of trouble, then you're actually going to have a better life. You're actually going to be happier. Your well-being will be better. You'd have a better standard of living all around. It's not just that we're going to lock you up, but if you are a straight honest citizen, you're actually going to have a better life. Is it actually possible to build something like that into the programs?
Absolutely. And that's one of the core principles of effective supervision of offenders. A lot of people don't really think about it that much, and they don't realize that offenders have goals as well. You know, there are certain things that they want to achieve in their life, and lots of times their involvement with the criminal justice system gets in the way of them achieving those goals. So one of the things that we try to do is to tap into their own intrinsic motivation, the things that they want to do, and explore with them how being involved in crime in the criminal justice system is keeping them from achieving those things, and begin to talk about options, different ways they could behave that wouldn't continue to draw them into the system and would make it more likely that they'd be able to achieve those things that they want. And then they begin to see that it's not just, I'm your probation officer, I'm telling you what to do and you have to do that because I have the authority to do that, but rather that we're together working on helping the offender achieve some things that they've already said that's what they'd like to do in their life. And, you know, another point about incentives and motivation, we as human beings change our behavior because we're motivated in a way that enables us to make the tough decisions to change behavior. Behavior change, whether it's losing weight or stopping smoking, it's never easy. But if we can find ways to motivate people to provide some incentive, lots of times they'll do things that otherwise they weren't able to do. And I think probably the best example of incentives in the justice system today is with the drug courts.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured this out a long time ago, and they provide lots of seemingly small, to some people maybe insignificant, rewards when offenders stay clean, don't use drugs, continue to work, are participating in their treatment, and so on. So they're constantly reviewing the person's performance and saying, good job, way to go. Sometimes it's just an attaboy or an attagirl. It might be a certificate of accomplishment. It might be a gift card from a local store that was donated by a merchant. They actually get some tangible rewards for doing the things that they need to do. And you look at the performance of drug courts around this country, it's extraordinary how well they have been able to do with people, many of whom are chronic addicts who've been using substances for years, and they're able to get them into treatment, keep them into treatment, keep them out of trouble, and return them to the community as a productive member of society. So we need to do things in probation and parole and in the correctional system that are based on science and research, not on intuition, gut feelings, political ideology. One of the things that I think is most fascinating about President Obama, he keeps talking about being an empiricist, being based on what works, talking about evidence. What do we know about this? Does this particular program work? And that's what we're talking about in community corrections. Let's do things that are proven to produce the outcomes that we want, and let's not do the things that don't produce what we're looking for.
We have about a little over 10 minutes left. A number of callers. We'll get in as many as we can. We'll get back to the phones here. First person in line is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. What does it cost to hold a person in prison?
Well, it varies from state to state, but it's in the neighborhood of $30,000 a year.
Uh-huh. Well, I figured about $33,000, and if you have 33 people at $33,000 a year, that's $1 million a year. My point is, they've legalized marijuana in 13 states for medicinal uses, and I haven't heard of any or read of any negative spikes in the behavior of citizenry. And meanwhile, those states are getting money from a multi-billion dollar industry, whereas if you keep, as I said, 33 people in prison for 1 year, that's $1 million a year that could have gone to the citizenry rather than people for smoking pot. The repeat rate, I heard even on a PBR this morning, of a reentry rate for recidivism, 50%. When you look at all the aspects, the repeat rate, the tremendous expense of people engaged in marijuana commerce, the similarities between prohibition of the 20s and prohibition of drugs now, the bootleggers had to get legal or get out of the business. If we legalize marijuana in a very restricted form, we could take millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, out of the hands of the narco terrorists. Plus, you add in the fact that the family has lost their chief breadwinner most of the times, and the male goes to jail. When he comes out, he's got little chance of getting a decent job. All he has to put down there on his resume is he's a convicted felon, and he has little or no recourse rather than to resort to some type of crime to just get by. That's my comment.
Well, all right, and you can comment on that any way that you like, Mr. Burrell.
Well, I think he's made a number of really good points. One, the analogy to prohibition and some others. And I'm not an expert in this area by any stretch of the imagination. But what I do have experience with is dealing with the aftermath of those policies when they are enforced. Millions of people under probation or parole supervision or in jail and prisons. Not too many people go to prison for marijuana possession, but nonetheless, they do have a conviction on the record now. And one of the things that we've been learning over the last few years is the extent of the impact of a criminal conviction on a person's ability to live a law-abiding life, something known in the business as collateral consequences of conviction. There are literally dozens of laws on the books in every state that are triggered when a person is convicted of a crime, particularly a drug crime. It can be things like suspension of driver's license, suspension of professional licenses, restriction on employment, restriction on living in public housing, restriction on getting public assistance, and so on. All things that we have set up as a society in response to drug use that made us feel good, but in the long run, I think have a counterproductive effect. Possession of marijuana is relatively minor when you look at the scheme of crimes we're dealing with, and to handicap an individual potentially for for their lifetime in terms of their ability to do the things that we want them to do, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
All right. Again, let's go on to another caller, and the next would be in St. Joe on line number 2. Hello.
Yes, it just seems our overall philosophy in this society is to push people away and out of healthy communities rather than pulling them in closer. I remember some years ago there were some American Indian youth who had committed some crime, and their way of dealing with it was they were going to take these youths on an extensive, you know, camping outing with some of the other men in the community. They wanted to more reestablish the bond. And, you know, we were just outraged because they were supposed to be locked up and pushed away. And it just seems that people, you know, need to be reintegrated and brought closer in communities rather than pushed away. Thank you.
Well, there's a very interesting theory and practice primarily in juvenile justice, but it's also extended to the adult side as well, called restorative justice. And it, again, looking at things through a different lens. An offender has committed a crime, but that crime has harmed the community, has torn the fabric of the community, has harmed an individual as well, probably. So the response of the justice system in a restorative model is to heal the community. And one way we do that is to involve the offender, for example, in a victim-offender mediation, in paying back financial restitution, in doing community service to the community if there's not a victim of the crime, but not in a, from a punitive perspective, but rather one that is reformative, rehabilitative, restorative, building some capacity within the communities to deal with offenders in a more constructive and productive way. I think, you know, the caller's right that we get mad at people who have violated the laws, and we want to push them away. We want them out of sight. The reality is that better than 95% of the people who are sent to prison will return to the community at some point in time. In fact, now that several states, my own included, have eliminated capital punishment, that the number of people coming back, the percentage is probably going to go up. So we will feel better for a short period of time while the offender's locked up. But in the long run, what happens to that person while they're locked up, they don't get any better, they probably get worse, so they come back to the community completely ill-equipped to live as a productive citizen, and then we're surprised and angry when they reoffend. It's not hard to figure out why it happens.
All right, we'll try to get at least one more caller. The next is in Peoria. This is line four. Hello.
Hi. That's an excellent segue into my comment. Going back to the community, not only not having any training, but my son's in prison right now, and I was involved in a counseling program that I worked with probation all the time, so it was kind of ironic. But there, in the prison that my son is in, they have the MRSA. In other words, they have that there's that bacteria that exists in hospitals that's resistant to antibiotics. And also, he just tested positive for TB. So keeping these people in that situation, in that kind of like confinement, all of these health problems then come back into the community, and it's a world unto itself. In Illinois, we put prisons in low economic developed areas, and then they. And the people who are in and we've cut out, the budget cuts have cut out all the, not all of, but a significant portion of the education and training. So, and the guards are people from economically depressed areas that really don't have experience in, you know, manufacturing or some other kind of jobs. So it's very odd. That's, you know, the people come out of those, not only, you know, stunted emotionally and educationally, but also sometimes with health problems. That's my comment.
Well, all right. Again, Mr. Brell, you respond to that any way you can?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good point. It's another area that I think that we have underestimated the impact on the physical health of people who've been locked up. We talk a lot about, you know, the mental health implications of total institutions such as prisons, but your caller is absolutely right. These are not healthy places. I worked in a county jail many years ago, my first job out of college, and it's not the kind of place you want to spend a lot of time in. So it's another reason why we shouldn't be as reliant as we are on incarceration as a tool.
All right, we'll try to get one more caller here, Vermilion County, line three. Have to ask you to be quick if you can, but please go ahead.
Great, thanks, guys. Just wanted to bring up some excellent information that came off of PBS. There was a special on methamphetamine, and the DEA officer showed charts that indicated that when pharmaceutical-grade ephedra was available to the drug dealers, that the addiction rates just went through the ceiling. And then when they were making them from, like, hardware chemicals and batteries and stuff, the addiction rates went down. So it's my considered opinion from watching PBS that the main problem is the pharmaceutical industries supplying actually the starter material. And then David had a show where Eldridge Cleaver's widow had indicated that she called, what did she say? She said there were street corner pharmacists that were acting as alternative economies, which we just take to mean that poverty is what's driving the use of drugs and the selling of drugs. And since Article 2 of the Constitution says Congress shall regulate trade, it looks to me like there should be political solutions here. And I'll let you guys comment.
Well, again, Mr. Burrell?
Well, again, this is not really my area. I know the whole idea of legalization or decriminalization of substance use and abuse is a very hot topic and one that I think deserves a full airing, but again, it's well beyond my area of expertise.
Well, fair enough. We're to the point here, Wabi, I can give you about a minute left. I guess at this point I'd say, what sort of thought would you like to leave with folks today?
Well, I'd like them to really understand that the correctional system in the United States, just as it is more than just prisons and jails, which is what we tend to think of, and that there are a lot of people who are in their communities, their neighbors. A lot of the offenders are concentrated in urban areas, but that doesn't mean they're all there. And if we have the good political support, financial support from the communities, from the governments that run these agencies, we can make a significant impact on the crime rates in these communities and reduce victimization, reduce crime, improve quality of life, get more people working, get more people supporting their families, and get them off public assistance, paying taxes. The benefits are substantial, and the investment is not that great. If you look at the comparative numbers in terms of the cost of prison, at averaging $30,000 a year, the cost of good probation and good parole is less than $1,000 a year. So we can get an awful lot for a lot more for our investment. And as that one caller talked about, 33 people and for $30,000 a year, talking about $1 million. A study was done a few years ago. They talked about the $1 million inmate, which is about what the average inmate costs over the life of their incarceration. So we could do a lot better with the money that we have.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, William Burrell, is an independent consultant. He specializes in a number of things, including community corrections. Formerly was on the faculty in the Department of Criminal Justice at Temple University. Also before that, he served 19 years as chief of adult probation services for the New Jersey State Court System. Mr. Burrell, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.